I'd like to introduce you to one of our newest sponsors, FunkyChunky.com. What is Funky Chunky? Funky Chunky is a website that sells a lot of different things, but it basically deals with popcorn, great tasting variety type popcorn. They sent me a gift bag and five different types. And my family and I, we ate them within about 5 minutes of getting them. My favorite was the chocolate pretzels. They don't only have popcorn, they have pretzels. This chocolate pretzels, let me tell you about this. Crunchy, salty pretzels laced with chewy, gooey caramel and a ton of chocolatey decadence make our chocolate pretzels mix so outright irresistible. Let me say that no one else got a hold of that. No one else did. But some of them ate the sea salt caramel popcorn that they had available. The peanut butter cup popcorn, which I thought was very well made. And Chip Zell Pop, which has potato chips and caramel and pretzels and chocolatey drizzle. And the Nutty Cocoa Pop, which I thought was awesome as well. I didn't find one that I didn't like. But, you know, if you say, well, what's your favorite? My favorite would be the chocolate pretzels. So if you want to get a look at this and get them a go, go to FunkyChunky.com and tell them that Jeremy McFarland from the Football's Family Podcast sent you. And we'd like to welcome everybody back to the Football's Family Podcast. And I am I'm actually kind of intrigued about this because I'm looking at the book and we got the author of this particular book on the show tonight. So I'll let him introduce himself and the book as well, if you would, please.
My name is David Neil Drews, and I've written Iron Tigers, a novel inspired by the team that conquered Dixie and launched Southern football. It's a work of historical fiction. I've blended the facts of the 1899 Swanee football team. For those who don't know, the University of South Swanee, as it's better known, is in the Cumberland Mountains, not far from Chattanooga, about 55 miles. And their 1899 team, in the midst of a 12-game season, went on a 2,500-mile road trip by train, and they shut out five bigger schools in 6 days. They rode the train for a day and a half, and they arrived in Austin, and the next day they shut out the Longhorns. Actually, they weren't the Longhorns at that point, but they shut out Texas 12-0, got on the train that night after going to a ball that the Texas German club, threw in their honor. And so like around midnight, they got on a train. They went to Houston. They shut out Texas A&M 10-0, got on a train that night, shut out Tulane 23-0, and took a day off. And then they went to Baton Rouge, shut out LSU 34-0, and got on a train the next day. Played Ole Miss and actually Memphis, and they shut out Ole Miss 12-0. And then they went back to the mountain, and they had three more games to play for the rest of the season. It had never been done and never will be done. I think the shortest amount of time the NCAA allows a team to play in between games, I want to say 4 days. Does that sound right?
You're more of an expert than I am. I'm more of a pro guy.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you can play a Saturday and a Thursday. So that's 1, 2, that's 4 days of rest. I'm fascinated by the early history of any of many particular sports. It can be cycling. It could be baseball, football to a great extent. I've been obsessed with the early years of football and the forming of the NFL in the 20s since I was a kid, really. But just, you know, golf, badminton, I'm just fascinated with how a sport began, how it evolved, rules, uniforms, equipment. And I'm also a big American history buff. So, and particularly Southern history. So, you know, the University of the South in 1899 doing this phenomenal going on this phenomenal adventure that they went on was when I found out about it. I as a fiction writer, I knew I had to create a piece of historical fiction to bring their season to life.
I pass by the University of the South every time I go to Georgia to see my family down there, and I didn't quite put Swanee and the University of the South together. Now, yeah. I'm looking at the 1899 Southern Intercollegiate Athletic Association final standing, and you talk about you write historical fiction. This is got to be science fiction. It says Vanderbilt went 7-2 that year.
Yeah. They would, as you might know, they were formidable for a good while.
They were.
Swanee and Vanderbilt were arguably the two best teams in the South through the 1890s. And then, you know, Swanee continued to be competitive really into the teens, the 19 teens. And when they reached the 20s, football, thanks to Swanee, really, because they were at the vanguard of Southern football, and they did this amazing trip and accomplishment, which all of a sudden put Southern football on the map, because the Northeastern football establishment, and establishment for that matter, didn't pay any attention to Southern football. I mean, it wasn't like they even ignored it. They just they didn't even mention it. Southern football was rarely mentioned in Northeastern newspapers. And at that time in college football in the 1890s and thereafter for a while, the Big Four, you know, they weren't Clemson, Alabama, Ohio State, and Georgia, but they were Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and Penn. Those were the four most dominant teams in the country. And they got their start in the 1870s. The first college football game was 1869, and that was Rutgers versus Princeton. And so they weren't called the Ivy League schools yet, but, you know, what amounted, well, all four of those teams I just listed, you know, eventually were part of the Ivy League. But those were the dominant teams. And then the Midwestern teams got going in the 1880s. And we're talking about the University of Chicago, which is now Division, which is now Division III, like Swanee is now Division III, Northwestern, Michigan, and Wisconsin, and those were the Big Four in the Midwest. They got going in the 1880s. It got big, so essentially in the Midwest, and then the South didn't get going till 1890s. In fact, the first Southern team of note didn't start till 1889, and that was the University of Virginia. Swanee didn't start till 91. I'm a UT graduate, and my first collegiate football game ever was in 1970. First game I ever saw in person was 1970, Tennessee versus UCLA. So I understand you're an Alabama fan, but you still seem like a nice fella.
Well, I'll give you a story. I used to grow up, you know, Vanderbilt, Tennessee, and anti-Tennessee. Tennessee offered my son he passed away last year, but they offered him a position, a spot inside their school, you know, that just honorary spot. So I have nothing but good things to say about the University of Tennessee.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. And I have heard you talk about your son before. And I've got a friend who's going through that right now, 3 months into it. And, you know, you have my blessings. Absolutely.
Thank you. But no, I knowing Southern football, because I grew up in Tennessee, I've lived in Alabama, Georgia. I've been around Alabama, Auburn, Georgia, Tennessee, Vanderbilt. Some Kentucky, because I had friends who were Kentucky grads. Southern football seems to be rooted in people's DNA to the point that you cannot differentiate the DNA from the football. And it seems like what you're telling me is they were late. We were late to the ball game. I didn't quite realize that.
Yeah. Late to the ball game. And, you know, part of it was, as you probably know, the South was in the doldrums, the aftermath of the Civil War, the Reconstruction period.
Yeah.
The economy was in ruins. It still hadn't recovered. Urbanization didn't really start, and an industrialization didn't really start in the South. It got going in the 1890s too, but we were latecomers to that. And so the South was beaten down. And Suwannee, as you probably know, the University of South is an elite school. It is an expensive school, and it was founded by large slaveholders, primarily by an Episcopal priest. Actually, he was a bishop. He was a bishop in the Episcopal school, in the Episcopal faith. Suwannee is an Episcopal affiliated school, and he was the principal founder, and his name was Leonis Polk. And the principles of the founding of Suwannee was the notion to keep elite Southern, several ideas, but one of the principal ones was to keep elite Southern men from going to the Northeast to get their education. Because, many sons from very, very wealthy families would go to Princeton, they'd go to Penn, they'd go, the student manager for the 1899 team, because that tradition continued, went to Columbia for his law degree. So one of the reasons why they started the school was like, let's keep our future leaders, political leaders, business leaders, social leaders, let's keep them in the South and educate them the way we want them educated. The secularism, we still have that alive today to some extent. I think that there's still, I think less so now. I mean, I turn 60 next week. I think much less so now, but the South, from the war on felt like, the Northeast, but also other parts of the North looked down upon the South, and the South had something to prove. And you're talking about the DNA that was part of it. Let's create an elite school. In fact, they said the founding fathers of Suwannee said, they said, we don't want our young men to have to go abroad. And they meant the Northeast, and they also meant, going, across the ocean to get their education. We want them to be able to get the finest and the best here. And so they were trying to groom the heirs, what turned out to be the heirs of the Old South, to be Southern educated gentlemen, as they would put it.
You bring up the Reconstruction, which started pretty much as soon as Abraham Lincoln passed, which was awful for the South. We probably needed him as president at that time. You started with Andrew Johnson going to Grant, then on the way, probably I would say Reconstruction ended around 1900, something to that effect. Probably should have kept going. You're talking about not only rebuilding the infrastructure, you're talking about rebuilding farms, rebuilding the life of the person who had everything lost. But at the same time, you're talking about rebuilding the education system. Was Suwannee, to your best of your knowledge, and I apologize if I'm asking something that may not be on your wheelhouse, but best of your knowledge, is this one of the first colleges to really kind of stand out down South?
Well, I think Vanderbilt stood out. I think that Emory and Tulane. I think I don't know definitively when they started, but I think they were early prestigious schools for the South. But to give you an idea of Swanee's status in the 1890s, I read that the Vanderbilt students at that time referred to the Swanee students as the Blue Bloods of the South.
Vanderbilt students.
Vanderbilt's referred to Swanee students as the Blue Bloods of the South. Yeah.
Okay. That's weird.
Yeah. So as if Vanderbilt students aren't advantaged enough, it is as prestigious a school as it was and is today. They considered the Swanee students to be superior. And, you know, part of it was a jab, but also it was a recognition of the elite, very wealthy families that these, not all, but most of these student athletes came from.
It's insane to think that that area had a school that was looked upon, and not only that, but a football powerhouse for several years. Now I'm looking at this group, 1899 Swanee Tigers. There seemed to be around 15 players. They were two-way players, obviously.
Right.
Now, again, I know a little bit about football history to get myself into trouble. Was this more rugby type football, or do we have at this point what we're used to with the line of scrimmage and everything like that? I'm not really good on the dates.
Yeah, at this point, we have the line of scrimmage.
Okay.
I know you know the name Walter Camp.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
The father of college football. He brought the line of scrimmage in, I want to say, late 1870s.
Okay, so I'm off for a few more years. But yeah, I remember Walter Camp, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So, but it evolved. I mean, it kept, and that's part of what's so fascinating about it to me, is that it kept changing and adjusting, and you watch the pattern as it gets closer to where we are today. But yeah, 1906, the forward pass was illegal until 1906.
Yes.
So it was all pitching and you know, lateral and pitching behind you and handing off. You had three downs to gain 5 yards for a first down. And as you said, you had to play both ways, because if you came out of a game, you could not return to the game. And they wanted, you know, they had substitutes. They actually referred to them as scrubs. And it wasn't a derogatory term at that point, but they wanted to keep their 11 in. Their 11, you know, they had to play both ways. They couldn't come off the field, which, of course, you know, we know today, you know, is a dangerous thing, because everyone wants to play. Everyone wants to stay on the field. And so, you know, they're getting beaten up there, you know, out there really badly, and some of them should come off the field, but they're not giving in. So you had three downs to get 5 yards. You couldn't throw forward passes. You asked if it was more like rugby. It, you know, based on what I've described so far, yes.
It sounds a lot like rugby, yes.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like rugby. I don't think when you're on the Sports History Network, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I was on Darren Hayes' Pigskin Dispatch show about two Thursdays ago. And he said, you've got to listen to one of our podcasts next week, because we're having a guy who's a PhD in England, and he's an expert on rugby. And he's going to talk about not just how rugby contributed to American football, but also how American football created some modifications in rugby. So it's fascinating. If you go back and look for that, I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday. It's just absolutely fascinating. And Tim Brown's on there, you know, the football archaeologist guy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was just in Darren, all his knowledge, it was a great three-way. But, you know, to get back to your question, yeah, very much like rugby. But one big difference, and the big difference is punting. And they had punting as early as the 1870s. So you know, in rugby now, I don't know if this has always been the case, but you're not allowed to have a forward pass, but you can punt to someone on your own team. You know, and if they catch it, they can advance. But punting was a huge thing in early college football, because if you think about it, you know, once the forward pass came in to existence, and I know you know this, that, you know, in 1910, if a team threw 8 forward passes, that was probably a lot, you know, and then 1920, right. 12. And then, you know, today, what is it? You know, like in a typical NFL game, a team will throw what?
You can get 40 or 50 easy.
Yeah, exactly. So how do you advance the ball? How do you win the game of field position if you can't throw forward passes? They did it through the punting game. The punters were arguably the most important players on the team. And what would happen was they would get in punting battles where one team would punt the ball to the other team. The return man would catch the ball. Before he caught the ball, he would dig his heel. He'd make a divot with his heel in the field, in the turf. He would make a divot with his heel, catch the ball. And because he made that divot, he had to be given, you know, basically a 5-yard free zone. And he would kick very often. He could either, you know, down the ball there and his team could start on offense from that point, or he could kick it back. And very often they would go back and forth. And if they thought they had a better punter and they had a better team in terms of getting under the punts, they would just keep punting until, you know, in hopes and then, of course, encouraged to continue it if they were pushing the other team back against their goal line, that team's goal line. And so punting was just a huge aspect of the game, because field position was everything, because you couldn't throw a forward pass. So the fans that came out to these games, you know, today we want to see that great, you know, post route and, you know, the pass being dropped in the receiver's breadbasket. We want to see that. Well, back then they wanted to see spectacular punting, and they did. These guys, they had the ball was, you know, bigger. It was like a rugby ball. And because of that, they could, you know, if you miss kicked a little bit, it was forgiving because, you know, it was somewhat like almost like a soccer ball, somewhere between a soccer ball and a football today. But they would, you know, they had spirals, even though these balls were like melons, they had spiral kicks, and the fans would ooh and ah over this, over the punts, and they loved it when it went back and forth. Field position was so critical that there was a rule that if a team on offense lost 20 yards, they got a first down. If they lost 20 yards, they got a first down. Because why would you take the ball away from a team that you're pushing back and you're gaining field position on?
That wouldn't go over well today.
No, but you get the logic, right?
Yeah,
you,
I do. I do.
You can't throw forward passes. So you get, you know, think, you know, you get sacked. You 15 yards to go to for a first down, but you can't throw that pass. So the team that keeps driving you backwards, they want to keep doing that because they want to get as close to their goal line. It's field position. It's all field position. It is today and it was then, but different means to gain it.
This is fascinating. This is stuff that you can only learn from people who have delved into a topic like this. And David, just got a few more minutes that I want to run by you on a couple of things. How long did it take you to research and get this book together?
Five years.
The labor of love, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Now, these guys right here, I'm looking at them, 15 guys. They don't look very big at all.
Average weight, 169 pounds. The biggest guy was 6'2", 200.
Well, that's a big dude.
No, he was 6 feet, 190.
Okay.
Yeah. But the smallest guy was 126. He was an end, a gymnast, and he was one of their best football players. But 169 was even a small team average for back then. So they were small. You're right.
But that probably helped with their conditioning and with their ability to do what they did so many days in a row.
Being fit. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You mentioned conditioning. Swanee at that time, they didn't take summers off. The students went to school during the summer and they took winter off. So their summer vacation was during the winter months because the weather was so treacherous up there. And, heating wasn't as efficient and as comfortable as it is today. So they would go home during the icy winter months, and the other schools were in school were not at school during the summer, and Swanee was. So they would start conditioning for football in July. And so they had a head start. That was one advantage that this team did have over these bigger schools that they shut out all five.
Now, did you go to Swanee, to the University of the South for any of this?
Yes, I did. I went to the archives, and they've digitized a great amount of materials. So at home, I was also able to continue my research. And my best primary resource or primary source, this is so cool. The student manager was this guy named Luke Lee. In my novel, he's quote unquote played by Alfie Melville. The student manager was really the prototype for not just the future athletic department, but the future, or not just the future athletic director, but really the department. He did everything, the scheduling, the finances, getting approvals from the administration, everything down to when they went on this road trip, he wanted two barrels of the school's water supply put on the train so the players wouldn't get dysentery. So you think about all, at the major schools now. Yeah. You think about all of the, how many people are involved in nutrition, food, et cetera, for the teams today. This guy was named Luke Lee. Real quickly, on Luke Lee, this guy was committed to Southern football becoming a vehicle for the resurrection of Southern manhood. And he wanted Swanee, his team, his school, to be at the vanguard of that one, wanted Swanee to take the lead. And so that's why he did this. One of the reasons why he did this he put together this insane road trip. I'm losing where I was talking about Luke Lee. Can you bring me back to your question? I apologize.
I'm just listening. I'm just looking at him. Colonel in the U.S. Army, fought World War One, I should say. Mm-hmm. Senator for Tennessee.
At the age of 32. Yeah, he was audacious. He really was. There was nothing he didn't try to do. He even tried to kidnap, you're not going to believe this, but this is documented. 5 days after World War One ended, he and a few other officers went on an unauthorized mission to kidnap the Kaiser to bring him to Paris to stand trial for war crimes.
He wanted to kidnap Kaiser Wilhelm.
Yep, and bring him back to stand trial for war crimes. This guy, and so he's a 20-year-old, and this is his first foray into the world, doing just what's daring and reckless adventures. I mean, you know, who goes after the U.S. Senate at the age 32, even back then? Who goes and tries to kidnap the Kaiser, the instigator of the First World War? But this was like his warm up for those efforts. You just got to keep in mind, he put his classmates on a train for 2,500 miles. It was a 9-day trip, but in the middle of that, they played 5 teams in 6 days. Again, he wanted to do something spectacular. He wanted to make money. Swanee was having a hard time as a school getting students to come up there. And in the South, the state schools weren't rolling yet either, because education just wasn't a priority yet. But these New South guys, you know, these New South young adults, they wanted education to be part of the New South. They wanted to be that, and they wanted an emphasis on that. And they felt like that was also something that football could do. And, you know, you talk about the DNA, something that football could do to draw more Southerners to the state schools. And in addition to Swanee, which was having a hard time, they needed money. They needed money to build the football program. So he's going all the way to Austin. He's going to pick up games on the way back so he can make more money for the program and the school. And this all ties back to your original college football team, the Vanderbilt Commodores, because Swanee and Vandy were rivals. And Swanee rarely got a team to come up on the mountain because it was a school of 326 students, all male. And so there was really no gate to be had. So you bring your team all the way up there and they're not making that much money. So Swanee always went to play Vanderbilt on Thanksgiving. And of course, Nashville, they would get, and you know, Vanderbilt, you know, I don't know how many times bigger than Swanee at that time, but I'm sure several, like the rest of the schools were, that they played. Vanderbilt would bring out 5,000-6,000 people, which was a huge crowd back then. That was a big crowd. And so money was to be made by Vanderbilt. Money was to be made by Swanee. In 1898, Swanee beat Vanderbilt. Football experts considered Vanderbilt and Virginia as the two best teams at that time in the South. I would argue that Swanee was better. They certainly were better in 1899, but there is argument that they were the best in 1898 even. But in the 1898 game, Swanee, of course, played in Nashville. And then when it came time leading up to the fall 1899 season, Luke Lee was in negotiations with the Vanderbilt student manager. And Luke Lee felt that the revenue sharing structure was unfair towards Swanee, and that Swanee wasn't getting as much money from the game as they should. And then I also read somewhere that somebody speculated that that Luke Lee felt that not only did they get cheated by not getting enough of before the game, getting an agreement where Swanee got enough of the share, but at least one source speculated that Luke Lee also felt like they cheated Swanee at the gate. They didn't give them the revenues that they actually were due. Oh. So he's in negotiations with Vanderbilt to set up the fall 1899 game, and they reach an impasse. And so Luke Lee, and he's a son of Nashville. I know you know the Belle Meade neighborhood. Oh, yeah. Yeah. His family owned that land and eventually started that development. For those of our listeners who aren't familiar with Nashville, this is the oldest money neighborhood, a pretty good sized neighborhood in Nashville. Correct me if I've missed.
Oh, it is humongous.
Yeah. So, you know, this is Nashville, his hometown. His father's in banking. They're landed. They own slaves. Up to the Emancipation Act. But this was another bold move by Luke Lee. And he's like, okay, we're not going to play you, Vandy. Well, that was their biggest money earning opportunity every year, to go to Nashville and have this big game on Thanksgiving. So he's like, well, we're going to go out to Texas. We went out there last year. We didn't pick up any games on the way back, but this year we're going to. So he had dual, or at least two main purposes. He wanted to do something spectacular to launch the South as a football region. He wanted the Northeast to pay attention to the South, start paying attention to the South, knew he had to do something that would make the papers. And shutting out five teams in 6 days, nobody was doing that anywhere.
Well, we got just a couple more minutes. Thank you for being on here. This is absolutely fascinating. Where can they get your book?
Okay, so folks can go to Amazon. And in the search bar, put in Iron Tigers Drews, D as in David, R-E-W-S. And you can also go to Book Baby, which they provide better royalties for the authors. But if Amazon's your place, then yeah, please go there. But Book Baby, you just put in Iron Tigers. So Amazon, put in Iron Tigers Drews, and at Book Baby, put in Iron Tigers. You can also go to my website, which is irontigersfootball.com, irontigersfootball.com. There's a 90-second quote-unquote movie trailer we had created, which is a coming attractions style video for the book. There you go. Yep.
I will put this on the episode description. I'll put all these listings there. So all you have to do is just look on the show description and follow. Where can they follow you, David, on Twitter?
Put in David Neil Drews. I don't know my actual handle. Let me see if I can pull it up real quick here for you.
I have it. It's just not in front of me.
Okay, here I can get it. Profile. Okay, it's at Drews, D as in David, R-E-W-S, Neil, N-E-I-L, and then number one.
All right, we'll have that on there as well. Zoom is about to kick me off. Thank you, David, for getting on and telling us about this. And I will make sure people know how to get a hold of your book.
Thank you, Jeremy. I hope you enjoy the read, and I appreciate your show. And it's been really good to talk to you.
Thank you, buddy. Thank you all for listening to Football's Family.